Lecture 3, Tomb Robbers and Hieroglyphs.
This is an account of villains and heroes, of adventure and skullduggery and downright villainy along the Nile, of notorious tomb robbers who used force to get their way, and a story, too, of a handful of quiet scholars who spent years recording tombs, temples, and inscriptions out of the public eye. At this point, in the third lecture in this course, Napoleon's armies have left Egypt, but new invaders have descended. Diplomats with instructions to loot Egypt, and ruthless collectors out to make a fortune off the pharaohs. We see in this lecture how the looters' finds cause a frenzy in European capitals, but at the same time the first Egyptologists arrive in Egypt, among them John Gardner Wilkinson, an Englishman whose story forms the second part of this lecture. The publication, as I said last time, of the Description de l'Egypte caused a major stir in Europe, where both private collectors and major museums entered into a frenzied competition for mummies and ancient Egyptian antiquities. The way they did this at first was a little sneaky. Both Britain and France appointed diplomatic representatives to Egypt, which was still a province of the Ottoman Empire. The British consul was a man called Henry Salt, based on Cairo. The French consul was a Genoese called Bernardino Drovetti, based on Alexandria. Both of them were instructed by their governments to collect as many antiquities as possible. Of the two, by far the most ruthless was Drovetti. He was a collector who didn't hesitate to use force to get his way. He surrounded himself with a gang, to use the old-fashioned word, of ruffians, strong men who were not afraid to beat up his competitors. Henry Salt worked almost entirely through third parties. And the most famous of these parties is one of the most extraordinary people ever to become involved with ancient Egypt. A man from Padua, his name Giovanni Belzoni, a circus strongman turned tomb robber who was employed by Salt in 1817 and then struck out on his own. Belzoni, by any standards, had an extremely colourful career. He was born the son of a barber to conditions of great poverty. While a teenager, he wandered around Europe selling religious statues. He was tall, thin, very good-looking, and immensely strong. And when there was a danger that he was going to be drafted into Napoleon's armies, he fled to England and got a job on the stage at Sadler's Wells Theatre in London as a strongman. Now, today you think of Sadler's Wells and you think of opera and fairly high-level entertainment. In those days, it was a very, very lowbrow music hall. And Giovanni Belzoni was given the name the Patagonian Samson. And he would wander around the stage, carrying an 150-pound metal frame upon which were balanced 9 people. He was known as the Patagonian Samson. He became famous. He performed in circuses and fairs right through the Napoleonic Wars until 1816. During this time, he acquired an expertise with levers, gunpowder, and what are known as hydraulics, the shifting of weights using water. Very useful qualifications for someone who was about to become a tomb robber. In 1817, having tired of the circus life, he arrived in Egypt with the idea of mechanizing agriculture for the Pasha, Muhammad Ali. But his plans were sabotaged by Muhammad Ali's officials, and he ended up penniless. It was at this point that Henry Salt employed him to move a statue of Ramesses II from a tomb a temple near Thebes, where it had even resisted the efforts of Napoleon's soldiers, who had an entire army behind them, to move the statue that was lying in the sand. Belzoni took with him some palm trunks, some rope, and travelled up to Thebes, hired 300 men, levered the statue up using his expertise as a strongman, built a crude car from the palm trunks, rolled the sculpture to a riverbank, built an earthen bank, rolled it up, lowered it onto a waiting boat, and eventually transported it to Cairo. And if you go to the Egyptian room in the British Museum, you will see the head there. The only problem is that the gift is attributed to Henry Salt and not to Giovanni Belzoni. In fact, much of the Egyptian room at the British Museum was equipped or filled by Belzoni. From there, Belzoni became an active and prolific collector. He was really successful for two reasons. Firstly, he was very adept at handling the local people. And if he didn't get his way, he was perfectly capable of picking up a local headman and shaking the man, like this, until he agreed to what he wanted. Because although he was a gentle giant, he was very strong. He also had an absolutely uncanny ability to improvise from nothing. He would float sculpture down rapids with a makeshift raft using ropes. If he was in trouble with one of his competitors, he would always find a way around. He was the original wide man, very, very clever, and a man with great articulateness who could talk his way out of almost anything. The other thing he was very good at, and this is true actually of many very good Egyptologists, is he got on very well with the local people once they realized he was serious. And among the people he befriended were the tomb robbers of Kurna, which is a village opposite Luxor on the west bank of the Nile, which in those days made its living from tomb robbing. And mainly these people would rob the thousands of mummies stacked in rock-cut clefts in the cliffs above Kurna, penetrating deep through tunnels which they only unknown knew, and at night camping outside their houses and using wooden mummy cases as firewood. And Belzoni befriended these men because he was trying to collect papyruses and other art for his own collection and for Salt. And he went on many memorable expeditions, practically stripped naked, into these deep, odoriferous and dusty clefts. "I sought a resting place," he wrote once. "I found one and contrived to sit. But when my weight bore on the body of an Egyptian, it crushed like a bandbox. I sank altogether among the broken mummies, with a crash of bones, rags, and wooden cases, which raised such a dust as to keep me motionless for a quarter of an hour, waiting until it subsided again." Those were the days of dramatic discovery and adventure. And when I tell you, by the standards of tomb robbers, Belzoni was one of the better ones, you will understand the scale of the problem. His achievements in three brief years were astounding. He was the first European in modern memory ever to penetrate the temple of Ramses II at Abu Simbel with the famous facade of the seated king. Looking for treasure, he found nothing. He penetrated for the first time, probably since medieval times, Khafre's pyramid at Giza. He had this gift that a few great archaeologists have of being able to sense where to dig, and he dynamited his way into one of the passages from a certain point on the side of the pyramid and penetrated to the burial chamber. And if you go into that burial chamber, look high on the wall, because there, written on the wall in soot, is the name Belzoni in large letters. Kilroy has been here. But his most spectacular find of all was the royal tomb of the great pharaoh Seti I in the Valley of the Kings. The Valley of the Kings has been known as a royal burial place ever since Roman times. Napoleon's scientists searched in vain for tombs. They found none. They figured they were all known. Remember in those days nobody could read the name of the pharaohs. Belzoni arrived. He found two royal tombs in a week. He had this extraordinary instinct as to where to look, the telltale signs. But the most important tomb he found was the tomb of Seti I. This tomb, and these tombs are magnificent. They penetrate deep below the ground. Rock cut, long defiles and chambers, and the walls of the defiles are magnificently engraved and painted with scenes of the afterlife, of gods and of kings making offerings. And when Belzoni penetrated Seti I's tomb, he found that much of it had been robbed, but on the walls were these magnificent paintings. And the other side of Belzoni's character was that he was a showman. He wasn't really in this ultimately for the money, although he liked money. He was in it for the fame, the visibility. He was above all a showman. And when he found Seti's tomb, he realized at once that here was a chance for a spectacular display. And he spent many months copying the paintings in the tomb and making an accurate copy of the sepulchre. Because when he finally penetrated to the burial chamber, which is magnificent, in the middle of it was only one artifact there, an alabaster sarcophagus, so beautifully crafted that while Belzoni lit a candle in the middle, the light shone through the walls. He removed this and the other exhibits and shipped everything to London. Because in 1819, he had such a violent confrontation with Bernardino Giovetti and his ruffians, in which shots were fired, that he figured quite rightly that his life was in danger. And he fled to London. Those, as Howard Carter, the great Egyptologist who found Tutankhamun's tomb, once said, those were the great days of Egyptology, when if you didn't like one of your opponents, you went for him with a gun. And whatever you say about modern archaeology, we certainly don't do that anymore. So Belzoni went back to London, and he presented a magnificent exhibit of ancient Egyptian antiquities, including Seti's sarcophagus and a copy of the tomb, in a hall appropriately known as the Egyptian Hall, whose facade was somewhat in the Egyptian style. And this exhibit was a sensation. People flocked to it. Remember, nobody had seen an Egyptian antiquity. He unwrapped several mummies in the presence of distinguished audiences. This was really wonderful stuff, the equivalent of a rock concert of the day, where people would attend the unwrapping of a mummy. I mean, it was really a cool experience for the people there. Unusual, exotic. And of course, to own a mummy was very prestigious. But while he also became the rage of London society, it is said that he had the most beautifully broken British accent, which the ladies found absolutely irresistible. And he was very charming, apparently. And he also wrote a book with his adventures, which isn't very well written, but it's a classic. But he discovered something which he probably knew anyhow. You can only keep it up a certain amount of time. And he had his show, and it was a display, and everyone loved it, and everyone went. And then the public's interest shifted onto something else. He took it to Paris, and the same thing happened. And he realized he had to get something else. Otherwise, he was dead as a showman. So he went off all by himself, leaving his wife behind, who lived many years after him, to West Africa, searching for the source of the Niger River, which was one of the great geographical goals of the 19th century. The man who found that would be made. Totally remote country in the southern heart of the Sahara. He landed in what is now Nigeria and died of fever within a week. But if ever there was anybody in archaeology, in the discovery of ancient Egypt, of all the early civilizations, of whom you can use the famous quote about Sir Christopher Wren with justification. If you seek my monument, look around you. It is Giovanni Belzoni. And the next time you go to the Egyptian room at the British Museum, look around you. A surprising amount of it is there because of an Italian strongman. And the damage that looters and other tomb robbers like Bernardino di Giovetti did to ancient Egypt was incalculable. But only one thing you can say about them. Regrettable as their methods were, they enriched the major museums of Europe with large collections. And Belzoni's exhibit and his best-selling book raised the consciousness of ancient Egypt among the general public and educated people to new heights. It also probably stimulated the study of ancient Egypt. For, as the tomb robbers ransacked ancient Egypt, Jean-François Champollion, as we found in the previous lecture, deciphered hieroglyphs. And at the same time, the Napoleonic Wars brought a steady but growing stream of adventurous travelers to Egypt. It was much easier to go there. The government was more favorably inclined to Europeans. Many of these people, of course, took a few antiquities home with them. The desire to acquire and collect among people is irresistible, particularly if you delude yourself that the find is worth some money. But there were others who came just to sketch, observe, and admire. Remember, this was the days before photography, so sketching was a common art. And then there were few scholarly visitors who stayed much longer, men and women who were the founders of Egyptology. As we saw in Lecture 2, Jean-François Champollion himself made a triumphal visit to Egypt in 1828. His party sketched and translated and collected, but they made no effort to be systematic in these efforts. But an Englishman, quiet, self-effacing man, John Gardner Wilkinson, who came to Egypt in 1821, was the complete opposite. Gardner came as a young man. He developed an interest in ancient Egyptian writing while at school. He'd even gone as far as to study hieroglyphs using Thomas Young's methods and arrived in Egypt before Champollion announced his decipherment. Wilkinson had some private means, didn't have to work, and was in no hurry. He was a man of rather leisurely temperament, and he lived in Egypt for 12 years, much of it living in considerable comfort in cleared ancient Egyptian tombs. One lived in some style because you could live for almost nothing, surrounded yourself by servants, and there was in Egypt at the time a small community of Europeans, many of them artists, who were enjoying what one can call a somewhat relaxed and occasionally somewhat dissipated life among the tombs. Wilkinson learned Arabic and Coptic, and also tried to work with Champollion. He verified and corrected some of Champollion's decipherment, which you are told didn't please Champollion much at times, because his work was still very controversial. But he devoted much of his time to copying tomb paintings and inscriptions. Now, Wilkinson was about the first scholar to go there who could read the inscriptions. He could identify pharaohs, he could identify nobles, he could establish the ownership of individual tombs. And all this work, which ended in the early 30s, culminated in Wilkinson's great work. In 1837, he published a three-volume masterpiece, and I don't think it's too strong a word to call this a masterpiece. The Manners and Customs of the Ancient Egyptians. This remarkable work covered new ground. It described every aspect of Egyptian life, from chronology of the pharaohs to funerary rites, from geology to daily life. The point about Wilkinson's work was that it is written very largely on inscriptions, and for the first time it was an account not just of monuments, or of sculpture, or of inscriptions. It was about people. And the ancient Egyptians themselves came across as farmers, hunters, tax collectors, pharaohs, priests, nobles, as people who'd lived and died and been happy and unhappy. In short, the civilization came alive as something created by people. And I do stress the word people, because throughout all these discoveries we're talking about, ultimately, so many people think of these things in terms of temples and monuments, inanimate objects. When you're dealing with societies which were as complex as our own, of nobles and commoners, of people who loved and hated and lived and died and became sick and quarreled and reconciled, ethnic minorities, everything, slaves, farmers, people who made their living in every way imaginable. And for the first time, with the publication of Wilkinson's work, we got a few insights into a civilization as a living entity. His work was the most monumental and comprehensive account of ancient Egypt published in the entire 19th century. And it's not exaggerating to say that it placed the study of Egyptian civilization on an entirely new footing. It is really an amazing book. You can still read it and get a lot out of it. And it became a bestseller. Today, bestsellers tend to be what you might call mass media entertainment, and many of them are what euphemistically are called page-turners or airport books. John Gardner Wilkinson's book was an intensely serious volume, and it's like Austin Henry Layard's book on Nineveh, or John Lloyd Stevens's book on the Maya, which we'll talk about later in the course. It became a bestseller simply because it was about an exotic subject, and it was beautifully written. And some of the fan mail, which John Gardner Wilkins, who was actually, quite frankly, a rather lazy gentleman. He took life fairly easy. And there's one letter which is worth quoting. The reader wrote to him and said, "We turn over the leaves and are at once, as it were, in another world. 3,000 years roll backward and we live familiarly with people, the most interesting and hitherto the most unknown of any that have appeared among us." Right on. That reader, whose name is lost, put his finger right on it. For the first time, an ancient civilization truly lived. Wilkinson, of course, was not alone. There were others who did invaluable work, among them an artist called Robert Hay, who visited Egypt at intervals between 1824 and 1838, and accumulated an enormous archive of paintings and inscriptions of tremendous value, because many of them record inscriptions and tombs and sites which no longer exist. And one of the very important things to realize about all these civilizations is when the first pioneers went there, they saw so much more than we do now. The sites had not been ravaged by industrial pollution, by the pollution of thousands of tourists treading over them, by the generation of looter, or by the ravages of the local people, some of whom sell antiquities for a living, or others who simply use the stone to build houses or plough the material away. They saw so much more than we did. So their accounts, incomplete and by modern standards inadequate as they often are often the only record of critically important parts of the history of early civilizations. This is very true of the work of Wilkinson, Hay, and others. Because of their time, the destruction was widespread. Most excavations were, at the best, crude, including some carried out, I may say, by John Gardner Wilkinson himself. He never claimed to be a scientific excavator, but then nobody knew how to excavate in those days. The most spectacular finds still came at the hands of tomb robbers. What were they looking for? Mainly at Luxor, on the west and east bank. Why Luxor? Because there were so many tombs on the west bank. They were looking for mummies, papyri, which of course are the little inscriptions buried in the bandages of mummies, and statuary. The more spectacular, the better. They were shipping it out of the country and selling it to the highest bidder. On contrast, Wilkinson and his colleagues worked with very minimal budgets. They never had official support, like Napoleon's scientists did, or later German expeditions to Egypt did in the 1840s. And it truly is remarkable how much research they completed in the face of such widespread destruction and looting. And it's worth here saying a few words about excavation. Excavation, as we know it today, a systematic process of recording, only goes back to the 1870s in Greece and the 1880s in Britain. Excavation before then was little more than crude tunneling and literally potato digging, looking for the most spectacular find as fast as possible using large numbers of labourers. Belzoni and Dravetti between them literally dug over the whole of the temples of Luxor and Karnak looking for material, and a great deal they found. The loss was incalculable. And one of the tragedies of the discovery of the ancient civilizations is that so much was lost. It is remarkable, on the other side, how much we do know, and much of it is due to the fine-grained researches of modern science and also the pioneer work of people like Wilkinson and Hay. We owe them a great debt. By the 1840s, ancient Egypt was relatively well known in Europe, even if Egypt itself was somewhat off the beaten track even then for European travellers. It took railroads and steamships to make it more accessible, as well as the Suez Canal. But it was still assumed that it was the earliest civilization in the world, an assumption that was not challenged for another quarter century after the time of Wilkinson and then in Mesopotamia. In this lecture, we've looked at how the finds made by Napoleon's scientists triggered a tidal wave of looting along the Nile. This looting, while very regrettable and extremely damaging, raised public consciousness of ancient Egypt. At the same time, it also fostered the first pioneer efforts in Egyptology, the first systematic description of an ancient civilization. But I think the most important thing of all that this very early work did was to show that the study of civilization, as I said before, but I reiterate again because it's very important, isn't just a scramble for antiquities. And it isn't just finding the most spectacular temple, deciphering the script, or unearthing a magnificent palace. It is the discovery of people. And John Gardner Wilkinson's greatest contribution was that he made sure that people realized Ramesses II, Seti I, Amenophis, and all the other pharaohs, many of whom were enormously influential and important in their day, the greatest and most famous people in the world very often, actually were living people and took the very, very scanty account of Egypt in the scriptures and the less than adequate descriptions in classical writings and showed that they had a solid basis in historical fact. And in the 1840s, you cannot blame people for thinking that ancient Egypt was the earliest civilization in the world. Why did they do this? Because Egypt had suddenly become accessible to the traveler, thanks to Napoleon and thanks to a changed atmosphere in the country after the Napoleonic Wars. But Mesopotamia, the cradle of the Garden of Eden, The lands to the east were still remote and completely off the beaten track. And it's hardly surprising that it was some time before we found that there were equally early civilizations between the Tigris and the Euphrates to the east.